is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Iran condemns the use of unilateral sanctions as political leverage in relations between countries, saying they are a major obstacle to global humanitarian activity. Reaffirming support for Israel, the U.S. opposes Al Jazeera taking the killing of its journalists by Israeli forces to the International Criminal Court. And a new report says Canada has wasted billions of dollars on unused COVID vaccines and pandemic aid to people who are not eligible to receive it. Hello everyone, and thanks for tuning in to World News. Our top story, Iran has once again condemned the imposition of unilateral sanctions by some countries against others as political leverage in bilateral relations between states. Iran's deputy ambassador to the UN made the remark while addressing a General Assembly meeting on humanitarian aid. She described unilateral sanctions as a major obstacle to international humanitarian efforts. The Iranian diplomat added, "Such sanctions are also a breeding ground for all kinds of human crises across the globe." She also voiced Iran's concern about the deviation of humanitarian aid as well as non-humanitarian activities undertaken under the guise of humanitarian aid. Iran says it's dismantled a number of operational cells affiliated with MKO terrorist organization. In a statement, the intelligence ministry said the cells of saboteurs were smashed in the provinces of Tehran, Isfahan, and Kurdistan. Said the elements of those cells were arrested, adding they were involved in terrorist activities and mortar attacks on Iran's administrative, military, police, and residential centers. The ministry said those terror activities caused damage and insecurity to the country, noting all those cells were directly guided by European base of the MKO terror group located out of Albania. The intelligence ministry also reported the confiscation of weapons and equipment used by the terrorists. Iran says recent riots in the country were fomented through foreign interference and represent a hybrid war against the Iranian people. Now, Western countries, the U.S. in particular, are trying to pressure Tehran by using human rights as pretext for removing Iran from the U.N. Commission on the Status of Women. Tehran has slammed the move, calling it illegitimate.
Tehran has slammed Washington's move to push a draft resolution aimed to remove Iran from the UN's Commission on the Status of Women. Iran's foreign ministry says any misuse of the internal developments in Iran to exert political pressure on the country is condemned and unacceptable. Iran has just started a four-year term on the body after a recent voting session by the UN Economic and Social Council. Tehran has repeatedly warned that some Western countries are exploiting human rights for their own political ends. In recent weeks, rioters went on the rampage across the country, brutally attacking security officers and causing massive damage to public property as Western powers, especially the United States, provided support. The European Union and some Western countries have imposed sanctions on Iran over its approach toward the riots. Iran's foreign ministry spokesman Nasser Kanani said that the U.S. and certain European countries are behind the political and illegal draft resolution and that they are seeking to exert pressure on independent countries to pass it. He said the U.S. move is an action against the free vote of countries in international organizations and structures and questions the legality of such mechanisms in international bodies. He added, there are member countries of the UN Security Council or the Human Rights Council and Human Rights Assemblies that committed countless crimes against governments and independent nations throughout their history, and now use human rights tools to exert pressure. Iran has lashed out at Western officials for cheering rioters in independent states while suppressing peaceful protesters in their own countries. Iran's foreign ministry says countries that have coups, conspiracies, interventions, and devastating wars with millions of deaths in their history are now pretending to be defenders of human rights in other countries. The best example would be Western countries' hypocritical behavior vis-a-vis protests in Iran and their own states. Western officials say the protests in Britain, Germany, France, Canada, and Australia are bad and deserve severe confrontation, but riots in their targeted countries are good and deserve support.
Now, Iranian officials have criticized the U.S. over its push to remove Iran from the U.N. Commission on the Status of Women, saying that they're acting dictatorially under the name of women's rights. Tehran has vowed to use all of its political and diplomatic capacities to prevent that move.
The riots in Iran began after the death of a young woman named Mahsa Amini in September. She collapsed at a police station in Tehran and later died at a hospital. Since then, the issue of women's rights suddenly caught the imagination of the world. The self-proclaimed human rights champions in the West, who turn a blind eye to gross human rights abuses in the US and Europe, are accusing Iranian authorities of killing the woman, even though all evidence, including the forensic report, scoffs at those claims. The Islamic Republic has strongly censured several countries for provoking riots in the country through their spy agencies and propaganda apparatus. London, in particular, hosts several anti-Iranian networks, including Iran International, Manoto, and BBC Persian. The U.S. is pushing for the removal of Iran from the U.N. Commission on the Status of Women, following trumped-up claims by foreign media that attributed the killing of women to the Iranian government during the recent unrest in the country. They claim that they are acting in defense of women's rights, but they are in fact violating those rights and preventing women from raising their issues through pushing for the removal of Iran from the UN Commission. The 54-member UN Economic and Social Council is expected to vote on December 14th whether to oust Iran from the commission or not.
Anti-Iran media networks are reporting a three-day strike by Iranian shopkeepers as part of recent unrest in the country. But in Tehran, shops were open today and people were busy shopping, as our correspondent reports.
According to foreign-based news channels, a three-day strike was supposed to sweep across the country from Monday through Wednesday. But a quick walk around the streets of Tehran, especially its Grand Bazaar, shows the shops are all open and people are busy shopping for their own needs. There are videos circulating on social media purporting to show some shops in Tehran's Grand Bazaar closed. People say, however, that these shopkeepers have closed their shops in fear of vandalism. In some cases, rioters have rendered shopkeepers unable to open their shops by putting glues on their locks. Also, there is news that unknown gunmen have opened fire on some trucks whose drivers were not willing to stop working during the three-day strike. Meanwhile, Iranian Judiciary Chief Ghulam Hossein Mohsen Ejei has warned that those who threaten or force sellers close their shops and join the strike will be identified and prosecuted.
Look around here. All shops are open. Thank God people are doing their daily shopping. This is a message to London-based media outlets. We are Iranians, we love our country, and we have unity. What you broadcast on your TV channels are mere lies.
Before coming to the Grand Bazaar for shopping, I had been told that there might be a strike. But as I have walked around the streets, I see no sign of a strike here. I think those who call for strikes are only making fun of themselves because a majority of people do not care about them.
The country has been gripped by riots for 10 weeks now, with the unrest claiming the lives of civilians and security forces.
The Islamic Republic says foreign media outlets are overstating what's going on in Iran to fan the flames of unrest. Officials are now calling on rioters to calm down, warning them against playing into the hands of Iran's enemies. Salman Kujuri, Tehran.
A U.S. judge has dismissed a lawsuit against Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman over the killing of journalist Jamal Khashoggi. federal judge in Washington said the suit submitted by Khashoggi's widow made a strong argument that Prince was behind the murder. However, he said he had no power to reject the U.S. government's position that the Prince Mohammed has immunity in U.S. courts as a foreign leader. Khashoggi was murdered in Turkey in 2018 after he went to the Saudi consulate in Istanbul to get his marriage certificate. U.S. intelligence reports say Mohammed bin Salman had approved the operation against Khashoggi, but Saudi officials have denied the reports. The U.S. has opposed the move by Qatar-based Al Jazeera News Network to submit the case of the slain Palestinian journalist Shireen Abu Akleh to the International Criminal Court. The State Department says the ICC should focus on its core mission, which is serving as a court of last resort in punishing and deterring atrocious crimes. Al Jazeera says there had been complete cover-up by Israel over Abu Akleh's killing. It says based on its rulings, the court must identify those directly involved in her murder. The network says it has new evidence challenging the regime's claim that the journalist was accidentally killed by crossfire. Abu Akleh was shot on May 11th while covering an Israeli raid on the Jenin refugee camp. Regime has defied calls for an investigation. Israel says it will not cooperate with any external probe into her death. A new development in the trial of pro-Palestine British priest Reverend Stephen Sizer over alleged anti-Semitism charges. Saeed Puraza has your details.
A Church of England disciplinary tribunal for this man, Reverend Stephen Sizer, one of the leading figures in the debunking of Christian Zionism. The purpose of the tribunal, to hear 11 anti-Semitism accusations against him. His main accuser, the Board of Deputies of British Jews. The accusations against him, sharing a platform with Holocaust deniers while attending peace conferences in the Middle East, and sharing on social media articles containing anti-Semitic conspiracy theories from other websites. The 68-year-old priest declined to comment after the hearing, but people close to him say he's been crucified for criticizing Israel.
Those Jews like me and many others who worked with Dr. Sizer for many years know for sure that he's the last person on this earth you could call an anti-Semite or racist. He is the kindest, very careful person, and he's anything but the opposite of anti-Semite. He is against what Israel is doing, so am I, and so are many Jews in this country and across the world.
The problem arises from the controversial International Holocaust Remembrance Alliance's definition of anti-Semitism, which conflates criticism of Israel with hatred of Jews.
Now is the time the Church of England really needs to stop on the IHRA. It can't come out and say they have reservations with the IHRA and then still use the same definition. This makes no sense in any shape or form and needs to be addressed seriously. It's basically like saying, We agree that this is wrong, but we're still going to go ahead with it because we don't really care whether it offends Muslims or whether it upsets Muslims.
Today's hearing cleared the Reverend of 7 of the 11 allegations against him.
A final hearing is scheduled for next month. People close to Stephen Sizer say that this whole thing was a witch hunt that has taken its toll on the Reverend, on his family, and the people who support him and the Palestinian cause. Saeed Puraza, London.
And now EU finance ministers expressed frustration with Hungary over blocking billions of euros in financial aid for Ukraine. Hungary is at odds with Brussels over claims that Budapest is flouting the bloc's rule of law. Jerome Hughes reports from the EU headquarters in Brussels.
EU leaders are furious with Hungary for blocking an 18 billion euro financial aid package for Ukraine, the first tranche of which is due to be released to Kiev next month. Finance ministers from the 27-nation bloc came together on Tuesday to try and resolve the impasse, but the meeting ended in failure.
Ukraine is a country at war. It desperately needs our support, and we just cannot allow one member state delay and derail this EU financial support.
This debacle follows a European Commission proposal last week to freeze 7.5 billion euro in funding to Hungary from the EU budget amid claims that Budapest is not meeting the bloc's rule of law standards. Aside from Ukraine, EU finance ministers have major problems closer to home. The energy crisis in the EU, resulting from sanctions against Russia, is getting worse by the day. The European Commission warns of economic disaster if EU nations continue to subsidise high energy costs in an ad hoc emergency fashion.
That is why we encourage member states to improve the targeting of this measure, and we have recommended replacing broad-based priced measure with a cost-efficient two-tier energy pricing system.
Out of control, energy prices are making the cost of living crisis in the EU unbearable for households and businesses. Eurozone inflation is at 10%. The European Central Bank is aggressively increasing interest rates to try and tackle the problem. Economists warn forcing inflation down too quickly can also be dangerous.
Of course, if you have a persistent drop in prices, people might think, well, I'm not going to buy now. I'm not going to spend now because prices will come down. So I'm going to stay with my money in the pockets and wait for later. And of course, you don't have economic activity.
Croatia will become the 20th member of the Eurozone next month. EU finance ministers say Zagreb will be able to enjoy all the benefits. However, the euro has a troubled history, and so it's clear Croatia will also be exposed to potential risks during these incredibly uncertain economic times. Jerome Hughes, the EU Finance Minister's meeting, Brussels.
A new report presented to the Canadian Parliament says that the government has wasted billions of dollars of unused COVID vaccines and pandemic aid to ineligible people. Canadian Auditor General Karen Hogan says more than 27 billion Canadian dollars of overpayments should be investigated. She said Ottawa mainly relied on information provided by applicants and limited controls in order to expedite payments. Hogan said the government overbought vaccine doses and over 13 million of them were spoiled according to the audit. Most of the remaining stockpile is expected to expire by the end of this year. U.S. stocks have tumbled again as leading bank executives express worries about a possible recession next year, adding to investor unease. The Dow Jones Industrial Average finished down 1%. The broad-based S&P 500 shed 1.4%, while the tech-rich NASDAQ Composite dropped 2%. That's after J.P. Morgan Chase said there is a chance for a mild hard-to-hard recession next year. Goldman Sachs has also offered a similar forecast. Losses add to the toll this week after major indices also fell more than 1% on worries that the Federal Reserve's policy to counter inflation will be prolonged. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres slams the multinational corporations for turning the world's ecosystems into playthings of profit.
Ecosystems have become playthings of profit. With our bottomless appetite for unchecked and unequal economic growth, humanity has become a weapon of mass extinction. We are treating nature like a toilet, and ultimately, we are committing suicide by proxy.
Guterres also warned that failure to correct course will lead to catastrophic results. He made the remarks in a speech ahead of biodiversity talks in Montreal. Nearly 200 countries have gathered for the UN Biodiversity Conference, which is set to address environmental and climate issues. And that's it for your latest, everyone. Thank you for joining us here on World News.
This is IRIB English Radio. With you early in the morning. With you at midday. With you till the night's end. IRIB English Radio.
in the limelight.
Experts are saying disputes between co-hosts Canada and China are unlikely to disrupt efforts to reach a deal on protecting the environment. The United Nations conference chaired by China is scheduled for early December in Canada, but only ministers and non-governmental organization leaders have been invited to participate. We take a look at the world media's coverage of this story. British newspaper The Guardian has more for us. More than 10,000 scientists, government officials and activists will gather in Montreal this week from 7th to 19th of December for the world's most important biodiversity conference, eager to hammer out a deal to stem habitat loss across the world and preserve sensitive ecosystems. The United Nations COP15 Biodiversity Summit opens up on Tuesday, 6th of December, and will see countries negotiate this decade's targets for protecting nature after more than 2 years of pandemic-related delays and just over 2 weeks since the end of the COP27 climate summit in Egypt. There is growing hope that the summit will not only bring about a plan to save the natural world, but could also begin to mend the deep rifts between the co-hosts, China and Canada. In recent weeks, Canada has charged a Chinese national for espionage, alleged that China interferes in federal elections in Canada, and opened an investigation into an alleged secret network of illegal police stations operated by China in Toronto. At the recent G20 summit in Jakarta, the Chinese President Xi Jinping publicly rebuked the Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau after Canadian officials leaked details of their conversation. When you look at what happened recently, Canada is not the favour of the month in Beijing. President Xi Jinping has very little regard for Prime Minister Justin Trudeau, said Guy Saint-Jacques, Canada's former ambassador to China. And while China owes Canada for hosting this summit, officials won't want to go out of their way to praise Canada in any way or be seen as grateful. The COP15 summit, delayed by the coronavirus pandemic and China's strict public health policies, was originally scheduled to be held in Kunming, China, but was moved to Montreal, Canada, when Canada agreed to co-host the event. China has not issued invitations to world leaders, and Guy Saint-Jacques suspects officials are keen to keep the event at a working level, shunning much of the pomp associated with global gatherings. China remains the biggest emitter of greenhouse gases, and despite its best efforts to halt desertification in its northern regions, the country is grappling with a major biodiversity problem. Yet China is also the country that invests the most in renewable energy technology, especially solar power and wind power. Despite the recent spat with Canada, Guy Saint-Jacques noted that the two countries have long collaborated on environmental projects, a possible area of common ground in the weeks ahead. French newspaper Le Monde has also covered the same story. COP15, one of this decade's most crucial summits for environmental protection and the survival of humanity, is likely to take place without any heads of state present. Just a day before the opening up of the United Nations Conference on Biodiversity in Canada, China, which will chair the meeting, has sent invitations only to the ministers concerned and to non-governmental organization leaders to take part in the high-level discussions. As the plans go, we may not have the heads of state and government, said Elizabeth Maruma Marema, the executive secretary of the United Nations Convention on Biological Diversity. French Environment Transition Minister Christophe Béchu confirmed that he will go to Montreal, Canada, where COP15 is scheduled to take place from 7th to 19th of December. The consequences of just sending invitations to ministers and not the world leaders is that the presidency has somehow decided to give to this COP less relevance than it should have, said Oscar Soria, campaign director of the non-governmental organization Avaaz. Soria added, leaders have to show to the world that the highest level of international politics cares about environmental collapse. The stakes of COP15 are beyond measure since the conference is meant to establish a new global framework to halt biodiversity loss by 2030. None of the goals of the previous global agreement reached in 2010 in Japan have been achieved, and environmental degradation has continued to accelerate. Deforestation is currently at record levels. Vertebrate populations have declined by at least 68% since 1970, and 40% of land is degraded. However, preserving healthy ecosystems is essential for food, agriculture, human health, and even the fight against global warming. Lynette Ong, a professor of political science and China scholar at the University of Toronto in Canada, said Beijing is increasingly seeing the need for prompt and bold action on the environment. The stake is too high for bilateral quibbles to get in the way, she said.
Food for thought.
Hello everyone, and let us contemplate on a wonderful saying from the Commander of the Faithful, Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, peace be upon him. O people, he who notices his own flaws will give up chasing others' flaws. And he who is satisfied with what Allah has endowed him will not be sad for what is in the hands of others.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com Sbs.com.au/en.
This is A to Z. An introduction into an Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, the role of knowledge in a man's life. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome everyone, you're listening to A to Z program. I'm your host, Hussein Hinzano, and in today's lesson, we are talking about the role of knowledge in a man's life. Now, we must emphasize that all acquired knowledge, all acquired sciences, pave the way and broaden the facilities for man's true progress. They never bear a certain and indispensable impact on man's prosperity. No. As a result, learning in the form of mental reserves could not be considered as a potential perfection for man unless it becomes a means to reach qurba with Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Now, to promote ta'zim, to show the means to enjoy divine blessings so as to thank Allah, or to prepare the ground for the development of oneself and others. With respect to the issue set forth, our position towards pragmatism becomes more clear. The advocates for pragmatism, which is a manifestation of humanism, are of the view that science and art are valid if they provide a better standard of living. Now, in response to this, we mark that neither worldly life nor efforts made for individual and social welfare are possessed of genuine value. We'll be back in a few minutes.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parstoday.com.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back. You're listening to A to Z program from the IRIB English Radio. I'm your host, Hussein Hinzano. We are talking about the role of knowledge in the development of a man. Now, so that knowledge or science and art will become valid in the light of a man, the only thing which is essentially valid for man is the qurba of the Almighty Allah, and whatever facilitates this qurba will be valuable to the same extent and to degree that it serves a means. The perfection human being bears no label other than ta'zim and accepts no ism other than ilahism, and regards genuineness exclusive to Allah. There's a chapter in the Quran that states, Surah number 22, verse number 62, it states that is because Allah is the truth, and that what they call upon besides Him, that is the falsehood. As a consequence, neither acquirement of knowledge and art, nor individual and social work possesses absolute validity. All of them will gain validity only in cases whereby they are done to serve Allah and are carried out in the light of establishing relationship with Him only. Thank you so much for following up on this episode. We are happy we are following up on these programs. Until next episode, inshallah, we'll meet again. Fi amanillah, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
While campaigning in the U.S. presidential election, Joe Biden vowed to treat Saudi Arabia as a pariah. Once in the White House, he approved the release of a CIA assessment that concluded that bin Salman had ordered the operation that led to Khashoggi's killing. That said, in mid-July, Biden met with bin Salman in Jeddah, a meeting meant to reset the relationship between the two. And a few months later, despite all the ups and downs, the U.S. decided to shield the Saudi crown prince from lawsuits for his role in the killing.
Mr. President?
Yes?
You're coming under a lot of fire for your fist bump with the crown prince. I just wanted to give you a chance to respond to that. But also, how can you be sure that another incident, another murder like Jamal Khashoggi's won't happen again?
Well, God love you. What a silly question. How could I possibly be sure of any of that? I just made it clear, if anything occurs like that again, they'll get that response and much more.
The fact is, Washington has been quietly extracting concessions from the diplomatically isolated prince who has control over Saudi petrodollars. Just weeks before the ruling, Saudi Arabia launched a series of initiatives apparently to win Washington's favor once again. For example, at a meeting of the UN General Assembly in October, the Saudis voted in favor of a Washington-led resolution declaring Russia's annexation of swaths of eastern Ukraine illegal.
So the president is going to strategically think through what the review process is and how we move forward with this relationship. He's going to take his time to consult with members of both parties, with partners, allies, and with the Saudis as well. We've taken note since the OPEC Plus cut that Saudi Arabia voted against Russia at the United Nations and also pledged $4 million to support Ukraine's reconstruction and humanitarian needs.
The Saudis also played a key role in brokering a high-profile prisoner swap between Russia and Ukraine, in which some UK and US citizens who had been captured fighting for the Ukrainian military were freed. Since the murder of Khashoggi, the US has threatened the Saudis with holding or suspending arms deals. But in reality, suspending arms sales has been a far-off possibility. This past August, following his trip to Saudi Arabia, Biden approved over $3 billion in weapons sales. In fact, Saudi Arabia has been the U.S.'s biggest weapons buyer for a decade. Such deals have always worked as hush money received by a country that has made human rights the glossy cover of its foreign policy rhetoric.
If you look in terms of dollars, $3 billion, $533 million, $525 million, that's peanuts for you. Should have increased it. $880 million, $645 million, $6 billion, that's for frigates. $889 million, $63 million, and that's for various artillery.
The lavish purchases bin Salman has made not only from Western arms industries, but industries across the board, from technology to sports and entertainment to investment banking and construction, have been designed to rehabilitate him on the global scene.
It is an opportunity to reaffirm the strength of our strategic relationship. We will be signing important agreements, and we will have an opportunity to further discuss regional developments. But how to further cement this important relationship between our two countries, placing a particular emphasis on economic cooperation.
I believe we have also historical opportunities that we're going to finalize a lot of it today, linking the grid of electricity, which we can provide Greece and Southwest Europe through Greece with much cheaper renewable energy. And we're going to sign the MOU about that today. Also, we are working about hydrogen and how to turn Greece as a hub for Europe to hydrogen. That's a game changer for both of us.
In just another case, back in April, a Turkish court confirmed transferring the Khashoggi case to Saudi Arabia. 2 months later, Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan met bin Salman, the strongest sign yet of a turnaround in relations since 2018. Now, Turkey is expecting Saudi Arabia to deposit up to $20 billion into Turkish treasury bonds and accounts in an effort to boost the economically struggling country's foreign currency reserves. When several lobbying and public relations firms terminated their contracts with Saudi Arabia following Khashoggi's murder, the kingdom doubled down on the firms that remained on its payroll. In just the first 6 weeks after Khashoggi was killed, Corvus Communications, the long-serving PR agency for the kingdom in America, received nearly $18 million from the Saudi government. Saudi Arabia also gifted close to $270 million to 144 American universities in 2019. And a total of $440 million since the death of Jamal Khashoggi, and these numbers do not include funds yet to be paid out. Four years since Khashoggi's dismemberment and disappearance from the Saudi consulate in Istanbul, the rehabilitation of the Saudi crown prince is complete. Biden, after pledging on the 2020 campaign trail to make Saudi Arabia a pariah, traveled to the country in a visit that gave bin Salman the legitimacy he longed for. And the human rights concerns do appear in summaries of the leaders of the U.S. and Saudi Arabia but hardly rise to the level of a top priority for Biden's foreign policy team.
What was the Crown Prince's response to your comments about Khashoggi?
He basically said that he was not personally responsible for it. I indicated I thought he was. He said he was not personally responsible for it, and he took action against those who were responsible. And then I went on to talk more about how that dealing with any opposition to the or criticism of the Saudi administration in other countries was viewed as, to me, a violation of human rights.
For the U.S., the money in Saudi Arabia is too big to ignore, and the Saudi Crown Prince knows that very well. He has spent billions of the kingdom's petrodollars to erase the stigma of a murder, and the leader of the so-called free world seems happy with it.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
President Biden on Friday, 2nd of December, signed legislation to prevent a nationwide strike by railroad workers, the last step in resolving a long-running dispute between workers and major freight railroads. With his signature, President Biden ordered unions to implement a labor contract mediated by his administration that four unions representing more than half of unionized rail workers had rejected after a deal was struck back in September. We take a look at the world media's coverage of this story. The Reuters news agency has more for us. President Joe Biden signed legislation on Friday, 2nd of December, to block a national U.S. railroad strike that could have devastated the American economy. The U.S. Senate voted 80-15 on Thursday to impose a tentative contract deal reached in September on a frozen unions representing 115,000 workers who could have gone on strike on 9th of December. But the Senate failed to approve a measure that would have provided paid sick days to railroad workers. "It was tough for me, but it was the right thing to do at the moment. Save jobs, protect millions of working families from harm and disruption, and to keep supply chains stable around the holidays," Biden said, adding, "The deal avoided an economic catastrophe." 8 of 12 unions had ratified the deal, but some labor leaders had criticized President Biden, a self-described friend of labor, for asking Congress to impose a contract that workers in four unions have rejected over its lack of paid sick leave. "That fight isn't over," Biden said. "Railroads have slashed labor and other costs to bolster profits in recent years and have been fiercely opposed to adding paid sick time that would require them to hire more staff. A rail strike could have frozen almost 30% of U.S. cargo shipments by weight, stoked already surging inflation, cost the American economy as much as $2 billion a day, and strained millions of rail passengers." There are no paid short-term sick days under the tentative deal after unions asked for 15 and railroads settled on one personal day. Teamsters President Sean O'Brien harshly criticized the Senate vote on sick leave. Rail carriers make record profits. Rail workers get zero paid sick days. Is this okay? Paid sick leave is a basic human right. This system is failing, O'Brien wrote on Twitter. Congress invoked its sweeping powers to block strikes involving transportation, authority it does not have in other labor disputes. The contract that will take effect with Biden's signature includes a 24% compounded pay increase over 5 years and five annual $1,000 lump sum payments. American Association of Railroads CEO Ian Jeffries said none of the parties achieved everything that they advocated for. Without a doubt, there is more to be done to further address our employees' work-life balance concerns. Without the legislation, rail workers could have gone out next week, but the impacts would be felt as soon as this weekend, as railroads stopped accepting hazardous material shipments and commuter railroads began cancelling passenger service. The contracts cover workers at carriers including Union Pacific, Berkshire Hathaway, BNSF, CSX, Norfolk Southern Corps, and Kansas City Southern. CNBC has also covered the same story. President Joe Biden signed a bill into law making a rail strike illegal, preventing workers from walking off the job weeks before the Christmas holiday season. The bill I'm about to sign ends a difficult rail dispute and helps our nation avoid what, without a doubt, would have been an economic catastrophe at a very bad time in the calendar, Biden said on Friday morning. After his administration aided in negotiations for months and the sides reached a tentative agreement back in September, talks ultimately stalled and rail workers threatened a strike. Biden then asked Congress to intervene and the Senate passed the bill on Thursday, 1st of December, making a strike illegal. The initial agreement brokered by the Biden administration was accepted by all but four rail unions, who were holding out for guaranteed paid sick leave days. The opposing unions, though, represent the majority of rail workers in the United States. The workers and companies had until 9th of December to reach an agreement before they vowed to strike, which the industry estimated would cost the U.S. economy as much as $2 billion a day. Our nation's rail service is literally the backbone of our supply chain, Biden said on Friday. So much of what we rely on is delivered on rail, from clean water to food and gas and every other good. A rail shutdown would have devastated our economy. A strike by rail workers so close to the Christmas holiday season and a period of high inflation could potentially raise the economy. Biden was adamant that Congress sent the legislation to his desk by Saturday. Without an agreement, rail movement of certain goods was set to be curtailed as soon as this weekend, in preparation for the strike. Biden, at the bill signing on Friday, 2nd of December, said his economic advisers told him as many as 765,000 Americans, many of them union members themselves, would have lost their jobs. Railroad carriers begin prepping for a strike 7 days in advance, according to federal safety measures. The carriers start to prioritize the securing and movement of sensitive materials such as chlorine for drinking water and hazardous materials.
Palestine Declassified.
Hello, I'm Chris Williamson, and this is Palestine Declassified, where we investigate the Israeli regime's global war against solidarity with the illegally occupied people of Palestine. In today's programme, we'll examine the relationship between Germany's political establishment and the Zionist regime. This relationship extends to Die Linke, that was founded in 2007 as a left-wing alternative to Germany's SPD. But Die Linke's leadership has been very hostile to the concept of justice for the Palestinian people. Rather than being the radical left-wing alternative it claimed to be when it was established, is Die Linke more concerned with maintaining the political status quo in Germany? I'll be talking to experts to find out after this special report by Latifa Abouchakra about how Germany has responded to the existence of the Zionist entity.
Germany is hostile territory for Palestine. It is the only place in the world outside Palestine where it is effectively illegal to wave a Palestinian flag. Earlier this year, the Berlin police banned all pro-Palestine demonstrations, including the Nakba commemoration, and a protest at the Israeli murder of Shireen Abu Akleh. But why is Germany so backwards in its attitude to Palestine? The traditional response given is that the Germans are still trying to atone for the Nazi genocide against the Jews. But on the same day that riot police swooped on Neukölln and detained or stopped at least 170 people during the afternoon and evening of Nakba Day, by contrast, neo-Nazi admirers of Hitler's regime were free to meet and fly the German imperial flag. They were left unmolested. So something more fundamental is going on. Over the years, Zionist leaders have met with German counterparts, starting with the first Chancellor of West Germany after the 1939-45 war, Konrad Adenauer, and carrying on ever since. In 2008, Merkel addressed the Knesset, saying that Germany had a special responsibility for the security of Israel. In 2019, the German parliament voted to condemn BDS as anti-Semitic. Underlying this capture of German foreign and domestic policy by the Zionists is the influence of the US and the failure of denazification after the war. NATO was a means to contain both the Soviet Union and Germany in US interests. Declassified files show that the State Department intelligence saw NATO as a place to help West Germany satisfy its reasonable aspirations and contain any potential unreasonable ones. In addition, the CIA actively set up the intelligence service of West Germany, the Bundesnachrichtendienst, known as the BND. The CIA knew that the head of the agency general, Reinhard Gehlen, was a former Nazi and approved his appointment, even though he employed numerous former Nazis and known war criminals. He was, of course, a CIA operative. Gehlen made contact with Mossad in 1957, and in 1967, an ex-Nazi officer in Gehlen's group passed on information to Mossad on Syria and Egypt, enabling Israel to destroy a large part of the Egyptian and Syrian air forces with a preemptive strike. Gehlen also maintained a network of compliant journalists, as a trove of recently leaked files shows. A network of compliant scribblers and informants was set up in the editorial offices of Germany and deployed time and time again to directly influence politicians and policies. Put in the context of the significant number of paid CIA assets in the German media, as revealed by the writer Udo Ulf Kotten, it is no surprise that the German political system, intelligence, and media are united in their support for Israel's crimes.
As always, we're joined by our resident expert, David Miller. David's an academic and former professor at Bristol University and a leading British scholarly critic of Israel. David's a co-founder and co-director of the lobbying watchdog, Spinwatch. Our guest expert today is Phil Bevan. Phil worked in the Leader of the Opposition's office under Jeremy Corbyn. He's researched the role of the German left, and he's written a number of articles about how the Labour Party and the left more generally in the UK have been subverted. Welcome to the show. David, let me start with you if I can. What more can you tell us about this character Gehlen, the Nazi intelligence chief, who ended up running the West German intelligence service?
It's a fascinating tale. So he's head of Nazi counterintelligence, well, you know, one of the key areas, and he's then recruited by the CIA immediately at the end of the war, and the CIA makes sure that he is then placed, his network of intelligence network is then placed into West Germany. He becomes the head of West German foreign intelligence, and he remains there. He dies peacefully in his bed in 1979. And he remains there for some considerable time. The only reason he has to leave the intelligence organization is because his deputy is discovered to be a Soviet spy. So we have an organization which is run in post-war West Germany, run by a Nazi. He's disavowed Nazism, but he goes straight from being a Nazi intelligence officer through to being a CIA asset and into German intelligence. Now, does this mean that the German intelligence organization for the post-war period was effectively run by the CIA? Well, it looks a little bit like that.
Interesting. I mean, Phil, this Galen was